Ah, there we go. Well, good afternoon. We are here this afternoon to hear oral argument in these consolidated criminal cases, United States against quite a few of people, Brown, Ford, Bush, Poe, Derek Vaughn, Stanley Vaughn, Arnold Counsel, and Gregory Chester. So what we will do to make sure that everybody can coordinate as well as they can is, I've got the times that you've asked for your argument time on the appellant side and how much rebuttal you want. I will remind you when you're hitting your rebuttal time, since it's going to be a little bit harder without a timekeeper. And then you'll finish, we'll hear from the appellee, the government. And when the lawyer for the government is finished, we will give defense counsel 5 minutes in a separate room that you'll be moved to by the coordinator if you need to have any discussion about your rebuttal. And then after about 4 or 5 minutes, you'll come back and we will go through the rebuttal. And so I'll just call you in the same order that I have it here on the oral argument schedule. All right, so in that case, that means we begin with Blair Westover. Are you ready?
Yes, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Blair Westover, and I represent defendant appellant Mr. Gregory Chester. Because of the format, defense counsel wanted me to start out by just doing a quick outline of how we divided our efforts and where we want to put our emphasis, or we're hoping to put our emphasis today at least. I am in charge of the forfeiture by wrongdoing issue, as well as one half of the statutory maximum issue, specifically the issue that has to do with whether or not there are presentment clause problems because of the lack of specificity in the notice of special findings section. Mr. Greenberg is doing the other half of the statutory maximum issue, having to do with whether or not the categorical approach prevents the use of the Illinois aggravating factors. As to specific factual findings, Ms. Armour is going to be addressing Wilbert Moore and the special findings on Wilbert Moore as to those defendants. Ms. Bierma is addressing the Terrence Anderson murder. Ms. Geiger is addressing the Blewett Neely shooting. Mr. Blegen will be addressing the sufficiency of the evidence as to his client, Mr. Poe, on count 6. And the obstruction of justice charge for the Daniels murder. And Mr. Herman and Mr. Mitchell, on behalf of Mr. Brown and Mr. Vaughn, have individual issues that they'll be addressing. So with that, I guess I'd like to start out with forfeiture by wrongdoing. I guess one of the ways that I'd like to think about it is what a district court would be required to find, or a trial court would be required to find under common law to justify finding the defendant has waived his right to confrontation through some wrongdoing versus what the Pinkerton, a judge has to find today to find that someone is responsible for a co-conspirator's act under Pinkerton. And if you just line those
two. Before you go further, I just want to clarify what you're arguing. Is your argument that the Pinkerton theory should not apply at all to forfeiture by wrongdoing, or that the facts here don't support such a theory, or both? Because I don't think you're challenging or can challenge under Giles forfeiture by wrongdoing in the first instance.
No, I'm certainly not saying that forfeiture by wrongdoing isn't a legitimate, a well-founded common law rule. We're not challenging that. Our position is that after Giles, using Pinkerton to sort of vicariously waive forfeiture by wrongdoing for co-defendants doesn't work, because that sort of waiver would not have been recognized at the time of the ratification of the Sixth Amendment, essentially. Now, this court in Thompson obviously applied the principles of the forfeiture of wrongdoing under 804b6 and said basically acquiesce. The word acquiesce, as it's used under 804b6, means basically the same thing as Pinkerton, right? And as far as that applies to the federal rule of evidence, I think that works. But Crawford requires that under the Sixth Amendment, the exception actually be recognized at the time of the ratification of the Sixth Amendment. And I
Ms. Westover, could I just ask you this then? I perhaps am oversimplifying what I understand the government's argument to be, but basically it's that Pinkerton is fundamentally an agency theory. And even at the time of the adoption of the Sixth Amendment and the Bill of Rights, there was an agency understanding for forfeiture by wrongdoing. And so if you sent your agent out there to eliminate the witness, you had taken enough action to forfeit by wrongdoing. And that's fundamentally this. Once you've got somebody who's agreed to the conspiracy, they understand the scope of their reasonably foreseeable acts, they're in furtherance of the conspiracy, all of the things that go along with Pinkerton, wind up about there at the agency level. So why isn't that solid?
A couple of reasons. One, I don't think it's solid because Pinkerton doesn't get you anywhere near what would have been recognized as agency that imputes actions at common law. Like, at common law, you had to directly participate and intentionally directly participate in the project, right? So in Lord Harrison's case, I think it was, he sent someone to bribe a witness, right? He said, here, go bribe a witness for me. He's an accessory. Common law would have recognized that. Under Pinkerton, you don't even have to know that somebody is going to do something. It just has to be the type of thing that was reasonably foreseeable to you, right?
Well, isn't that close to knowledge? I mean, you've joined this and there's an act that's reasonably foreseeable. So I'm concerned actually about the other side, whether under your theory, one finds forfeiture by wrongdoing only in the unusual case where you actually are the one who, say, kills the witness, and everybody else just designates somebody to take whatever actions are necessary.
I want to address the second question first, because I think that's kind of the heart of it, right? Is there's this intuition that that seems really unfair. And I don't disagree with that intuition. I do, however, think that, one, on the other side of it, you're talking about having someone's actual right to confrontation waived based on something that they might not have intentionally done or known about. And I think that's a heavy constitutional right to sort of have someone waive.
Wouldn't you agree? It's not that they completely don't know about it. It has to be something within the zone of reasonable foreseeability.
Well, a lot's within the zone of reasonable foreseeability. And I think this points out the real problem with the Pinkerton doctrine here is that at common law, not even knowledge was enough, right? And I forget the name of the case off the top of my head, I apologize, but this court has held that where somebody kills a witness and the obvious consequence will be that they couldn't be present at a court appearance, that isn't enough. You have to, under the common law, this type of specific intent you need is really, really specific.
I think it's a husband-wife one, but he was just killing his wife, as I remember. He really didn't care about court proceedings and witnesses. Well,
I think the language is dicta, but believe in that case, this court wrote, he was doing it to avoid a divorce or the filing of litigation is distinct from testimony in court, is sort of what I'm getting at. But regardless, in Giles, the Supreme Court reiterated multiple times that what is required is the specific intent to cause someone absent from court. And
are you going to address a more particular element there? Because I'll just say, either for you or for the benefit of whichever of your colleagues is going to do this, the thing that had concerned me more about this forfeiture by wrongdoing in this particular case was the quality of the proof that they knew that a grand jury, that Poe in particular, knew that a grand jury proceeding was underway. You know, just the more detailed application of this doctrine here. Is that in the scope of your argument, or should I wait?
I'm going to leave to Mr. Blagan to address specifically Mr. Poe's level of culpability here. Obviously, okay. He says his contention is that the proof is insufficient. For the purpose of my argument, the rest of the defendants are sort of assuming. We're saying, even assuming that he killed Mr. Daniels for the purpose of keeping him from testifying, that is not enough. What they need to do is establish that each of the defendants intended that that would happen, like had the specific intent that that would occur and took some act in furtherance of it. Or, taking some act in furtherance might actually be more than they needed to do, but participated in some way that would have been at least cognizable at the time of the ratification of the Sixth Amendment. And I don't think they've done that.
Why wouldn't their joining of the conspiracy be enough? Why wouldn't that be sufficient to be the act, as long as it's reasonably foreseeable under general Pinkerton principles? Why wouldn't that satisfy your concerns?
Well, I think that there's some sense in which, in some cases, it would make sense to say that the act of joining is the wrong that caused a person's death. But that doesn't obviate the intent issues. I mean, I don't think that anyone in the particular purpose of joining the hobos was not to kill witnesses. The government's proof didn't go to that level. That wasn't... I think theoretically, like I'm imagining, I've thought a lot about the thought experiment. What if there was a conspiracy that was like the murder of witness club, right? Would the act of joining that club be sufficient to be the wrong that causes the witness's death? And to some extent, I think that might be enough for the act, but it's not going to, I think it might be enough for the intent in that case. But then you'd have the act problem, which is, did it actually lead to a specific witness's death? But I think that experiment would be closer. But the government didn't prove in this case that that was the purpose of the hobos. It might have been a natural consequence of what the purpose of the hobos was. But I don't think that's enough under a common law understanding of agency.
So Ms. Westover, you have now gone on for the 11 minutes you asked. So if you would like to...
I just briefly go to the statutory maximums. Again, all I'm right. Interested in whatever question you have. It's our contention, obviously, that, it's obviously our contention that the statutory maximums, the defendants need to be specifically noticed in the notice of special findings section or named in the notice of special findings section, and they weren't. Our position is that the government should have done in this case what they did in Benabi. The government cites Benabi. What we think the government should have done is exactly how the Benabi worked. Defendants were listed in the notice of special findings section and if so noticed, they were then the special findings were submitted as to those defendants. If the defendant wasn't included in that, there wasn't a special finding as to them, and at least one defendant was capped at the 20 years, despite being held responsible at sentencing for the same murder. And just to touch on Chester's suppression issue briefly, I think that the problem here is that the district court erred in applying the collective knowledge doctrine as to Sanchez. I think unless the government could actually establish a Sanchez's evidence based on what they presented, that the statement should have been out for lack of probable cause.
Did you raise that argument with the district court?
We did raise that argument with the district court. The government's complaint is that we didn't specify exactly, well, the district court said, I'm finding that he knew about the search warrant. And we had said, we don't think he knew about the search warrant. We could have probably articulated better, and we think the search warrant doesn't establish the connection, but I think we preserve the error.
Okay, I think we'll pause on you at this point, and we move to Mr. Greenberg. And you indicated you wanted 7 minutes of argument and 5 of rebuttal.
Well, 7 was what I got collectively. I would have taken the whole 60. Your Honors, picking up sort of where Ms. Westover left off, a couple of the defendants in this case weren't named under Apprendi as committing any crimes. What the indictment said is it said in the enhancement section that the named defendant should be enhanced. What the court did was even beyond that, though. We believe that the RICO law incorporates state penalties, but it brings into account how far in the weeds do you go when you're looking at those state penalties. So the RICO Act talks about the racketeering activity and what is meant by that. In this case, the court said, we're going to look at how the actual murders were committed, and we're going to use that under Illinois state law to find the penalty. So under Illinois law, murder carries 20 to 60. There are enhancements, holding, calculating, murder of a witness, all sorts of different factors. And different defendants were subject to different things, even the ones who were named in the indictment in this case. But there's different factors used under Illinois law to decide whether somebody is entitled to be sentenced to more than the statutory maximum penalty of 60 years.
So why wasn't it enough, though, for the district court, as Apprendi suggests it should have done, to submit questions to the jury to allow the jury to decide whether the particular person was subject to the more severe penalties? Illinois law does permit life in prison for the cold and premeditated and so on murders, and for murders designed to eliminate a witness. I'm just summarizing. But 1963 seems to say you look to the underlying offense. The jury makes findings that the underlying offense allows going all the way up to life. Why doesn't that satisfy you?
Well, there's a couple of things. One, some people were never alleged, even under Apprendi in the indictment, to have been involved in those crimes. So that's one issue, and that was sort of the issue.
Who are you meaning in particular? Because
Ford and Chester were not named in the indictment as being involved in the underlying activity.
But Chester doesn't get the life imprisonment either. Chester gets the lower sentence.
Chester did get the lower sentence. That is correct. Chester was not there for the event that they ultimately used against Ford. But neither one of them were named. But more importantly, this is a RICO conspiracy, a 1962D conspiracy. So all they had to show was that there was an agreement. It was the racketeering activity that was at issue here. So the racketeering activity, let's say, is murder. That's the racketeering activity. They don't have to prove in this case that murder took place. They don't have to prove how the murder took place. That doesn't matter. What we're saying is that Congress, when it enacted this law, Congress said, we're going to look at these different state activities, and we're going to look at the penalty for these activities. Congress has never said that when you use the state penalties for these activities, you're supposed to use them with all the bells and whistles, all the variations. They've never said that the phrase maximum penalty applies differently under the RICO law than it would in other situations. They haven't said maximum penalty plus enhancements. So in other situations—
How does your argument differ, Mr. Greenberg, from, say, a drug crime? You don't have to, when you send a drug crime to the jury, you don't have to prove for conviction purposes that the defendant possessed with the intent to distribute a specific amount. That becomes an Apprendi issue that the government can prove up, send to the jury, and the jury make the special findings. But for conviction purposes, you don't have to prove that up. How is this any different?
The difference is because in a drug case, you have a statute that says that if you possess this amount, this is the penalty. If you possess this amount, this is the penalty. And that amount, it's a different penalty. And in a drug case, it doesn't say, look at the state crime for the activity. The
but
drug
under your document, is looking, I was going to say, the RICO statute says you look at the predicate acts, though, and I don't know, I would turn your question around. Why should we assume that the RICO statute looks only to, let's say, the standard Illinois murder statute, not the one that would apply when the jury makes additional findings, just as the jury might in a drug case?
And I'll turn the question around to you. Why should we presume it does the opposite?
Because they said this, are you qualified for life? And with these extra penalties, you are.
But the RICO statute talks about the racketeering activity. It doesn't say to look at the specific act. It says the activity, and it defines the activity. So the activity is murder. This is a conspiracy. They could have been convicted of this particular conspiracy without any regard to whether or not the murder took place. The maximum penalty would be 60 years. There's nothing in the statute, in the RICO statute, that says when you charge a 1962D conspiracy, you should look at the penalty depending on whether or not the underlying racketeering activity was carried out
How do you think the jury would have answered the special findings if there had never been a murder? It found the agreement. It found that everybody signed on, purpose, continuity. It found all of those things. But then they are asked about the underlying facts.
Well, if there had never been a murder under Illinois law, there never would be any underlying facts. There wouldn't be, I don't think you could say to a jury under Illinois law, gee, if this murder had taken place, would it have been cold and calculating?
Well, that's right. I mean, you'd probably be back at the standard 20-year cap.
But when Congress changed the law and they went from the 20-year cap to say maximum penalty carries life imprisonment, they didn't say maximum penalty with all of these different variations of things. And that's the problem, is that we're expanding the RICO law and we're presuming that Congress wants you to be able to look at all how the activity is carried out. And nowhere in the statute does it say that the penalty should be dependent on what you did.
But it does say, it says that you can increase it to life if the violation is based on a racketeering activity,
right,
for which the maximum penalty includes life imprisonment. And that's what was sent to the jury, the specific racketeering activities.
And that's where I differ. The racketeering activity, Your Honor, was murder. It was murder. That was the activity. The racketeering activity was not murder committed in a cold and calculating manner. The racketeering activity was just murder.
Jury found otherwise.
But the law doesn't permit to ask the jury that question. We're reading something into the racketeering statute. That's our argument. We're reading something into it that we don't read into other statutes. In other situations, we look at the generic version of the crime. What is murder? What is burglary? What is this? What is that?
You're mixing apples and oranges, Mr. Greenberg, because you're going to a categorical approach argument. But the categorical approach applies post-conviction, when you're looking at to enhance a sentence based upon a prior conviction. And because we don't have all the details of the prior conviction, the Supreme Court has come up with categories and other approaches on how to look at those prior convictions. This is not a prior conviction. This is a present prosecution.
Right. But we're saying that it should be reflecting this because the statute doesn't say that you're supposed to look at how. It's the fact that you
have any case law where the categorical approach has been applied to a pending prosecution as opposed to a prior conviction.
No, I have no, this is a new theory that we have.
All right, and unfortunately, Mr. Greenberg, we're gonna have to leave it here for right now because time is passing.
Yes.
But you'll have some rebuttal time. So we will move along to Ms. Armour, who has 4 minutes.
Thank you so much, Your Honors. Good afternoon, Molly Armour for Arnold Counsel. I'm going to begin by very briefly addressing the murder of Wilbert Moore, and then I will turn to discuss the misapplication of the cold, calculated, and premeditated special findings against actually all the defendants. So I know we initially said that was to Moore, but I'm just going to address it more broadly as it applies to anyone that received that in the verdict.
So that's Moore, Daniels, Anderson.
And I believe also the murder for which Paris Poe was also charged by himself. I believe there's also cold and calculating as to that.
Mm-hmm.
So the evidence was insufficient to find Arnold Counsel and Paris Poe committed the murder of Wilbert Moore. The eyewitness testimony of Alan Pugh and Tijuana Jackson, the physical evidence, and the laws of physics and time and space are completely at odds with the testimony of Kevin Montgomery. This conviction hinges on his unreliable testimony, which must be viewed as a matter of law with caution and great care. Our brief laid out the numerous contradictions and physical impossibility of his story and the fundamental flaws in the government's theory and case. So unless there are specific questions regarding this murder, I will turn to address the special findings. Illinois has this statutory aggravating factor of cold, calculated premeditation. And that has its roots in the Illinois death penalty. And this was intended to genuinely narrow the field of intentional murder to those that are committed after an extended period of deliberation. This murder, these murders here in this case, do not rise to that level.
Is it possible the jury may have seen things differently? I mean, obviously we have a lot of facts and not enough time to talk about them, but for Moore, for example, I mean, there was evidence in the record that could suggest that people have been looking out for an opportunity to commit this murder for a long time, and the opportunity arose, and so they put in place a plan, they murder him, and so it's not like it was just suddenly, oh, let's just murder Moore, and that was the first moment they thought of it.
I know that that's the government's conception of what those facts show, and I actually just don't think there's any support in the record for the actual planning, a decision to want to kill a person. What I think there may be evidence in the record for, and we vigorously dispute that Moore was actually even a cooperator in this case, but assuming arguendo, that there was a reason to want to kill Wilbur Moore. Motive is not planning. Motive is desire. It is not action. And the proper application of this statutory finding, the special finding, requires action. And of
just
course-
Just ask you though, I mean, are you contesting that Moore was a cooperator? Because I thought there was evidence that that Moore had snitched on counsel, that Bush says Moore was killed because he sent the feds to counsel's crib. They find drugs, they find a weapon.
So we don't believe actually that he was a cooperator at all. We litigated this vigorously below in a Franks
hearing. You get around the court's finding from the Franks hearing that he had acted as an informant and had supplied the basis for the search warrant affidavit. That sounds like a cooperator.
So even if he is, that's just motive. That doesn't cross the threshold under what is required by the Illinois Supreme Court in Williams, which is a very definitive, very well set out opinion about where this applies, which is in special kinds of murders. And the temporal element is essential. The word essential is used in Williams to describe the importance of time. And we don't actually have any evidence in the record as to Moore, or we don't credit the minimal evidence in the record that he was actually, you know, aware of that. There's supposition, there are leaps that are jumped, but there
and
are
he
not-
He was aware of what? I'm sorry, Ms. Armour, that Moore was aware of what?
That Arnold Counsel was aware that Moore was the cooperator. So putting aside whether or not he was the cooperator, certainly awareness of that was one issue. But, you know, there has
to- What about Jones's testimony?
Jones is-
Statements to him.
Jones is incredible. Jones flip-flops repeatedly. He is like a caution and great care witness of the highest order. He sends a letter to IPRA. The police made me do this. The police made me do that. He goes back and forth on his story so many times. We set forth all the reasons in our brief why he cannot be believed as to any of this.
Okay, so Ms. Armour, I hate to do this, but you're gonna have to wrap up so that we can move on.
I will do so shortly. Convictions for murder require the closest of attention. And even under the steep standard that the defendants must meet, the evidence was insufficient as a matter of law and fact to convict counsel and Poe. And likewise, the special finding as to cold, calculated, and premeditated murder pursuant to a preconceived plan and design was misapplied against all defendants. Williams sets out a clear boundary, and this court must uphold those temporal requirements. Our position is it was mere moments in the Moore murder and many of the other murders. With that, I yield to Ms. Bierma, who represents Gabriel Bush.
Very good. Ms. Bierma. I can't hear you, Ms. Bierma.
Sorry, could you hear me now, Your Honors? So good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Erica Bierma, and I represent the appellant Gabriel Bush, and I will be addressing the sufficiency of the evidence related to the Terrence Anderson murder. and briefly, if I have time, the attempted murder of Andre and Darnell Simmons. I submit to you, Your Honors, that the evidence was woefully insufficient to convict counsel and Bush, but specifically Bush as it relates to the first-degree murder of Terrence Anderson. When we look at the evidence that was introduced at trial, it was a combination of eyewitnesses, cooperators, and physical evidence. The eyewitnesses were completely inconsistent with where the gunshots were coming from.
Why isn't that something for the jury to sort out?
Well, I believe, Your Honor, since that it relates to a special finding that the jury would have to sort that out, but I do believe that the government had insufficient evidence to support the verdict and that the jury could not have concluded that there was sufficient evidence to convict Bush of murder of Terrence Anderson.
And Bush does plead guilty in the state court to murdering Anderson.
To second degree murder in the state court, which carries an intent element with it.
Well, he pled to a second degree, which is that he acknowledged that there was a murder of Mr. Anderson, but I don't agree that it said that he had an intent to kill Terrence Anderson.
He admits that he did it, though. I understand that there's a different intent requirement in second degree, but it's hard to say that he didn't kill Terrence Anderson when he said he did.
In fact, there was a stipulation at trial that was read to the jury in which Bush admitted that he, without lawful justification, intentionally and knowingly shot and killed Terrence Anderson while armed with a firearm. How do you get around that? That was stipulated to.
Well, Your Honor, there were other parts of the plea colloquy that were not introduced at the time of the trial in the district court related to the Terrence Anderson murder. He did plead guilty.
Under the standard that you have to get around.
Yes, sir.
Given that stipulation, how can you possibly get around the fact that there was sufficient evidence for the jury to find the murder aspect?
Well, I think that for the murder aspect, because it required that there was an intent to kill Terrence Anderson, that standard was not met. It was because of the...
Again, the stipulation was that he intentionally and knowingly shot and killed Terrence Anderson.
Yes, Your Honor. There was a stipulation in the district court, but I do believe that he did not, or excuse me, strike that, that there was insufficient evidence based on the lack of completeness in the district court as it relates to the plea colloquies of the second degree murder, because it was a second degree murder, not a first degree murder that he pled to in the state of Illinois. But also there is insufficient evidence that the eyewitnesses could have met the government's burden, because the eyewitnesses couldn't identify where the shots were coming from. Another one of the witnesses was 100 feet away. It was dark out. And all he could identify is that there was a person wearing a white hat. We also have the cooperators.
Isn't counsel's DNA, I forget the facts sometimes, but I thought counsel's DNA was on that hat.
Counsel's DNA was in the hat, but they couldn't conclusively say when it was placed there or when it was there, because obviously at the time of this incident, there were any number of people running. You know, they couldn't say when the hat was placed there. They couldn't say how the DNA got there. And there wasn't any DNA in the hat connecting Bush to that hat, even though one of the witnesses had indicated that Mr. Bush had been wearing the white hat.
So let me, you're about to run out of time too, but I want to ask you a somewhat broader question that also relates back to what Ms. Armour was just saying. In this instance as well, there's evidence from people who you've made no secret of the fact were pretty unsavory people, said a lot of different things, et cetera. Counsel admits to Jones that he threw Anderson on the ground before Bush shoots him. We've got testimony from Montgomery too. the jury weighs these things. We're a court of appeals. I'm uncomfortable with the notion that we should parachute in from the top and say, we're going to set these aside because we think the jury should not have relied on aspects of these witnesses' testimony. There's no rule that says they have to take 100% or zero. They take what they want to take.
No, I agree with you, Your Honor. But when we're talking about Rodney Jones, I mean, as Ms. Armour said, I mean, he was incredible as a witness. I mean, he admitted on cross-examination that the information that he provided to law enforcement was in fact information that he had obtained from Fat Shorty, and it wasn't even information that he had himself. And I recognize that this is an extraordinarily high burden for a defendant to challenge the sufficiency of the evidence. However, I believe when you take all of the evidence in its entirety and you look at it, I don't believe that a jury could have concluded beyond a reasonable doubt that these defendants were guilty of these acts. And
okay, I think we might have to leave it there for right now. So
thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. And we move to you, Mr. Geiger.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon. May it please the court. I represent Derek Vaughn. Derek Vaughn is the younger brother of Stanley Vaughn in this case. And he was not part of the original indictment here. He was charged in the superseding indictment. And specifically, I'm here to address the sufficiency of counts 4 and 5.
That's the Blewett and Neely murders?
Yes, Your Honor. Blewett and Neely. It's the sufficiency of those murders that I'm tasked with arguing. And Judge, I heard you say in the, when Ms. Bierma argued about there are unsavory characters, and there sure are all the way around. But in the case of Blewett and Neely, there is one character who is not unsavory. There's Harold Jenkins. And Harold Jenkins is a disabled Chicago police officer who just happened to be there when that double murder was committed. And he provides an account of this double murder that is different from everything that was presented by the four other witnesses. And by that I mean, he describes an SUV as opposed to a sedan, and he only describes one car with shooters in it, or a shooter. He does not describe the train of vehicles that is the theory in the case. So we do have Harold Jenkins to consider here.
Now, Mr. Geiger, how do you get around your client's recorded statements with Johnson, who was cooperating, where your client described the guns that they have, identified the cars, admitted what happened, was even bragging, boom, boom, boom? How do you get around that on a sufficiency of the evidence challenge?
On a sufficiency of evidence, Judge, I have a tall order because of that. But in that recorded statement made by Courtney Johnson, my client, first of all, says, hey, I didn't shoot anybody. I was in the back car with this junky old 9mm, assuming he means 9mm when he says 9, and it doesn't even work.
Jammed, right?
He said it didn't work. I think Cashel Williams, he was one of the witnesses. He said he fired 3 times and his 40 jammed. I think the 9mm just didn't work or jammed. I'm not certain.
Okay, that's right.
You're right. Right, it didn't function. So, you know, the judge said, well, you know, you're still the eyes and the ears and you're there to assist with it and make it happen. The bigger problem, or one of the additional problems, is you have the cooperator. There's 5 witnesses here. You have Rodney Jones. Rodney Jones puts my client, he is the one person in the universe who says, I saw Derek Vaughn shoot at Neely and Blewett. He's it. And he does that on his second day of testimony after the government had already moved on to other incidents with Jones.
Does it matter whether Derek Vaughn actually was successfully, so to speak, shooting at them, or would it be enough that he assisted in the ambush, as the district court referred to it, and was helping the group, so to speak, kill those two?
Well, if he is helping the group kill them, so to speak, yeah, that is problematic. I cannot deny that, Your Honor. But what I can say is you know, Derek Vaughan doesn't even have Rodney Jones at, if you listen to that recording with that Courtney Johnson made, he doesn't put Rodney Jones at the scene. But yet Rodney Jones puts Derek Vaughan at the scene and says he hears him, or he sees him shooting when prompted to do so on the second day of his testimony. So that's a problem. And that
sounds, though, Mr. Geiger, like you're raising inconsistencies, and these witnesses were thoroughly cross-examined at trial about these various inconsistencies. Mr. Jones in particular was extensively cross-examined.
Yes, he was, Your Honor, because his testimony was tough to stomach, as was the testimony of Chad Scott, another cooperator, who put two people at the murder who weren't there. And then he had to be...
Why isn't it up to the jury, though, especially given the extensive cross-examination by very skilled defense lawyers here? Why isn't it a question just up to the jury to decide who to believe, how much to believe, which parts to believe, et cetera?
Judge, you are right. The question is up to the jury. I can't say that it's not. But what I can say is we also had Mr. Jenkins. And this makes this murder unlike any of the others. We have a true civilian sworn law enforcement officer witnessing the murder. And what he described.
I don't know of any law that says that the jury was required to prefer the Jenkins testimony over the impeached other testimony. Indeed, we have plenty of cases that say to the contrary.
Yeah, and Judge,
I think normally as a defense lawyer, you would not want us to say you should give priority to a law enforcement officer's.
Well, I get in trouble
if you're advocating that position.
I'm not advocating that position, but I am trying to point out that, you know, these sufficiency arguments, they're very difficult. They're very fact intense. And this is one where I think it needs a look, because, and if you get to the, when in the briefs, you see there's five witnesses, their accounts are not just different, and you would probably expect differences, especially with the time gone by. They are wildly different.
Okay, Mr. Geiger, I hate to do this and be a bad guy again, but I think your time is up. So we're going to need to move along to Mr. Blagan.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. The Poe sufficiency argument for count six, at least the part of it that I intend to address today, which talks about the sufficiency of the evidence of his knowledge of one of the three judicial proceedings that he had to obstruct, is not based on credibility or the jury's decision to believe a witness or not. It is based on and gives this court an opportunity to reinforce the proposition that the job of a district court on a Rule 29 motion, and then, of course, of this court and reviewing that denial or reviewing that decision, is you have to find the difficult to find line between reasonable and unreasonable inferences. And here I would suggest, at least based on the judge's ruling, the district court judge's, that the judge did not do that, because what he said was that the defense was splitting hairs by trying to argue that there was insufficient evidence and bad inferences or unreasonable inferences to support the proposition that Poe must have known of one of those proceedings.
Now, is it your position, Mr. Blake, I just want to make sure I'm being as precise as possible, that one of the elements of this statute is that Poe had to know either that there was a pending jury proceeding or a pending grand jury investigation, that just a pending investigation more generally by a police task force or by others who are empowered to investigate is not enough?
That's 100% correct. I don't think the government even disagrees about that. They had to list the judicial proceedings in the indictment, and they are listed. It's a federal grand jury investigation, and it is two federal criminal charges, one against Mr. Chester, one against Mr. Dillard. With regard to the grand jury investigation, that honestly, the judge's conclusion that there's a reasonable inference that he must have known about that because Chester told him charges were coming, that is a completely unreasonable inference. The district court judge based it on Poe's extensive experience with the criminal justice system. First of all, you have to have more than just experience to understand that federal prosecutions usually come as the result of grand jury investigations. They don't always, of course. There can be a criminal complaint before a grand jury investigation even starts. So even if Mr. Poe had the extensive knowledge, which the judge presumed he did, he wouldn't have known that there would be a grand jury investigation in any event. But more importantly, Mr. Poe's knowledge and experience all came from the state system, which allows for charges by indictment or information. You don't have to have a grand jury investigation in the state court. That's something, I don't know if the district court knew that or not, but that is an unreasonable inference. You cannot conclude that Mr. Poe would have known that there was a federal grand jury investigation in progress just because there were charges that were coming. He didn't even know that there were federal charges that were coming. All Mr.
He does say at one point, on the looser idea of investigation that we all agree is probably not the right one, that I guess there's a Zentmeyer says, was the confidential source working for state or state prosecution? And Poe crosses out state and writes federal and seems to try to write joint task state and federal. But that's not quite linked up to a grand jury.
Well, but and more importantly, it has to be, that's after Mr. Poe is already arrested. That's after Mr. Daniels is dead. And knowledge that he got afterward is not sufficient. It can't possibly be sufficient for him to have committed the crime with that knowledge. The crime was already over. The language that we said that Mr. Zentmeyer pulled was from the complaint that charged Mr. Poe and said that the person was a federal cooperator or cooperating with a joint.
But why wouldn't this be enough? This did come in afterwards, but he's talking about Keith Daniels and whether or not he was working for the state or state, regardless of whether this admission was made before or after. Why isn't it sufficient to support that he knew at the time it was a federal grand jury?
Because it only supports the proposition that Mr. Poe learned after he was charged that there was a federal charge potential or that there was a federal investigation.
That's one interpretation. But why is that, under your sufficiency of the evidence, the only interpretation of this?
Well, because it cannot possibly support pre-existing knowledge. You know, he also got indicted. That doesn't support the knowledge that he knew beforehand that it was a federal investigation. He also learned it during the trial. That doesn't support the proposition that he knew it beforehand, because everybody agrees there's not a single piece of evidence, no direct evidence that he knew it beforehand. And this is important, Judge, so I'm glad you asked that question. But there is no basis to conclude that because someone got their charges, that they knew the facts in those charges beforehand. That I would suggest, is an unreasonable inference, because it leaves out the time. And one of the other propositions that this court can reinforce with it, with what I think is the right decision here, is that when this court has said, when in a circumstantial case where an element, the evidence is equally balanced to guilt or innocence, then there, by definition, there cannot be proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And so I don't think you could even say it's 50-50. If it's even that the knowledge maybe came beforehand because he later had the knowledge, that's at least equally balanced and doesn't qualify as proof beyond a reasonable doubt.
Okay, I think we might need to stop there unless you have one irresistible last point.
My irresistible last point, I suppose, is that the government said that the circumstances of the arrest, which of course there's no direct evidence Poe knew of, would let him know there were federal charges. Mr. Chester was arrested by Chicago police officers, and there is no evidence that anybody knew that the feds were involved then.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much. Mr. Herman.
Yes, good afternoon, Your Honors. I'm going to address a separate issue from the what you've been hearing so far in the arguments. I represent Stanley Vaughn, and my argument is, and our basis of our appeal is focused on sentencing issues. Mr. Vaughn had pled guilty shortly before trial and was severed. He insisted on a jury trial for facts related to the Blewett and Neely and also the Jonte Robinson shootings, which the court found over our objection could expose him to a statutory sentence greater than 20 years. On the day of sentencing, Mr. Vaughn had a maximum sentence of 240 months. After the district court was finished imposing the sentence, he walked out with what was effectively a sentence of over 500 months based on a composite of the 240 months, the maximum for the RICO offense, tacked on consecutively to a 246 month sentence, which was imposed for what everybody in the room, aside from the government that objected, recognized was relevant conduct. So
aren't you making, though, basically a guidelines argument that when something is relevant conduct, the guidelines state that it shouldn't be fully consecutive, but that post-Booker, the district court recognizes, and it looked to me like everybody conceded, that's just advisory, and the judge did a pretty good job, I think, explaining why he thought that the conduct in the Central District was just such a small part of the overall conduct that he felt that a fully consecutive sentence was called for. I don't see the legal error in that.
Right. We did all agree that the guidelines post-Booker are advisory, so the judge could therefore exercise his discretion.
Even though the word was shall, the judge
correct.
Didn't
I'm sorry. But nevertheless, there is an order in terms of the analysis that's set out in, I believe it's 1B1A8, which is the judge still has to go through the 5G1.3, apply the Chapter 5 adjustments. This is what this court recently said in the De La Cruz case, United States versus De La Cruz, where the concurrent sentencing guideline provision did not apply in that case because of the facts were different, because the defendant in that case had a discharged term. Mr. Vaughn had a fully undischarged term. The court in De La Cruz provided that step one is to adjust the sentence for any period of imprisonment that is not served on the undischarged sentence and run the remainder concurrent. Now, the district court can engage in that analysis, that proper analysis, and then at the end determine, well, here's the result. I find under 3553 that result is unsatisfactory. The court jumped that step entirely and did not apply 5G1.3. Instead, it engaged in an analysis that we think is contrary to the guidance of the guidelines and many decisions, which is
Mr. Herman, if I could jump in, please, before your time is up. You're relying heavily on 5G1.3 of the guidelines, but 18 United States Code Section 3584A provides that courts can impose a consecutive term of imprisonment to an undischarged term if they look to Section 3553A and determine that's appropriate. As you know, the guidelines are advisory. How do you get around this discretion that the statute plainly gives to the district court? And the district court, I don't think you will dispute, looked at the 3553 factors, all of them, in making its assessment.
It did, and this, my answer is going to, I think, blend together what should have happened under an analysis under Chapter 1 in looking to Chapter 5, which is,
and but if you could, again, you're relying on the guidelines.
Yes.
I'm relying on the statute. The guidelines are advisory. Even assuming everything you're saying about the guidelines may be true, they are advisory. The statute gives the district court the plain discretion to do exactly what the district court did. How do you get around that?
Well, the district court's discretion was obviously broad here. And I acknowledge that before Judge Tharp, and Judge Tharp is very experienced. Yet at the same time, what the court did under 3550 or under the statute in permitting it to look at that exercise, the guidelines still provide where the court should start. And this court has repeatedly said that you should start at the guidelines and then apply the discretion now of 3553.
Well, we've said you start with the guidelines for the guideline calculation, but is something separate. This is imposing consecutive or concurrent terms. I don't know that the law says that.
Well, Chapter 1 still instructs that in determining where you start before you get to the 3553A sections, you go through a list of 8 separate questions, in Chapter 5 being the last one. And what the court did here, instead of looking at whether or not the underlying narcotics activity from the undischarged sentence was incorporated in the RICO case, it flipped the analysis. And I believe I'm likely over my time. So if
you are over your time, so if you're
no other questions, I thank you.
All right, thank you very much, Mr. Mitchell.
Good evening, Your Honors. My name is Gregory Mitchell, and on behalf of Mr. Byron Brown, I guess it's appropriate I'm going last, since Mr. Brown actually came in first on this case, which is what seemed to create the problems that are raised in my brief. Essentially, I'm going to focus primarily on the two questions. One is whether or not there was sufficient motion filed for him to withdraw his plea that would require the district court to, or at least under these circumstances, grant a hearing so that the full record could be created concerning Mr. Brown's allegations. I think the court had made it very clear that when a person makes a very specific notation of errors or omissions, and then you decide whether or not the attorney, you know, had a basis for either disregarding or deciding something against it, the real question becomes whether or not this was a valid decision to be made, given the complexity of what was going on with Mr. Brown, which goes to the issue that I raised in the brief, that Brown simply went along with everything that was going on. He was interviewed on the state level by police before he was even had attorney present. He gave one statement, he gave second statements. He was so cooperative at the beginning because he understood what he was facing, and essentially spend, I guess, everything that he knew.
And what exactly do you think Mr. Brown's lawyers should have told him? I mean, surely they didn't need to say, don't lie. That seems obvious enough. And they were not wrong that a guilty plea had some advantages, even though not as much of an advantage as Mr. Brown apparently had hoped. But I'm having trouble seeing how the district court abused its discretion by refusing to allow him to withdraw the guilty plea, even without the evidentiary hearing, in light of what the record was.
The concern here, Your Honor, is really, did Mr. Brown really understand, once he advised his attorneys that what he had testified in the grand jury was a lie, in terms of some of the allegations he made against specific witnesses was a lie, and he couldn't go forward with that at trial. Once it became clear that he would have to now repeat, that's really the issue. And the question,
yeah, but that's what's so confusing to me. And I guess, let me just ask you another question. Does Mr. Brown right now want to just go to trial?
No, the issue here is whether or not his sentence, whether the government's allegation that he simply willfully violated the conditions of his plea agreement and therefore forfeited the deal, which is essentially what occurred. And it's not clear from anything at all whether or not Mr. Brown understood that was going to occur, because again, there's nothing in the record that it indicates that even through the Rule 11 colloquy or anywhere else, that he understood that he not only was going to have to testify in the grand jury, he was going to have to testify at trial in the face of these individuals.
And the judge did a very thorough, I'm sorry, Judge Wood. The judge did a very thorough Rule 11 colloquy, and it repeated what the plea agreement cooperation called for, and even said at one point something along the lines of, that includes in this case. How do you get around that clear admonition from the court?
Well, Judge St. Eve, my concern is, in my experience, again, when you talk about complex RICO cases involving these types of allegations, lawyers can explain to their clients that if you provide certain information against these individuals, the information is so overwhelming that that will be enough, that they're going to start pleading and things are going to fall down, and you're not going to even have to face that down the road.
Whether but putting or not- aside that, the court at the hearing made very clear, and your client said he understood that, and then the government reiterated that.
Again, Judge, I went through the record very carefully, and I understand what you say is clear, and I understand from our experience it may very well be clear. Well, Mr. Brown explained is that even though he told his attorney, and this is where the logic sort of follows his argument, even though he told his attorney that he essentially was going to be providing false information to the grand jury, what he learned from the attorney is that, listen, if you don't consistently testify to what you provided to the prosecutor, you're going to lose your deal before you even go in to the grand jury. So you've got to stay on course. And he did. The assumption then for him, given his lack of experience, is that he felt that if that was going to be his deal, if he did what he had to do to get the deal, then it's done. This question about what was going to occur months or years later for him to come in and testify, as we know in this particular case, there were problems with these witnesses left and right. And given the issues here that were clear up from the court, the fact that no one ever told him, you understand part of your plea agreement, you're not only just going to testify in the grand jury, you're going to have to stand here in court, face your gang members or whoever they are, and you're going to have to tell them and testify consistent with it. Do you understand that, Mr. Brown, given what the court knew about witness problems in this case? And there's nothing in the record to indicate that. And so I thought that if Mr. Brown was prepared to prepare an affidavit to say that that was what his understanding was, that we would at least get a hearing where the lawyers would come in and say, we never talked about, or we did talk about testifying at trial, and he was aware of that, or vice versa. And we just don't have that in the record here. We just have to assume. And then I think Judge Starr said, well, you had two attorneys, then are we gonna say that neither one of them addressed that?
Okay, I think we'll have to leave it there for right now, Mr. Mitchell.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. And thanks to all of you for your presentations. We will now turn to the government, to Ms. Kastanek, and hear from you.
Thank you, and may it please the court. Good afternoon, Andriana Kastanek on behalf of the United States. The properly instructed jury found, based on substantial evidence, that the hobos were an enterprise, that the defendants participated in that enterprise, and that they committed murders and shootings and other violent offenses in furtherance and in aid of the enterprise. The defendants on appeal repeat many of the same arguments that they made to the jury in this trial, including issues with witness impeachment, alleged inconsistencies in the testimony, alleged lack of physical corroboration. The jury was well within its discretion to reject those arguments and to find the defendants guilty, including based on 4 months worth of trial testimony that included cooperators who testified about their membership in the hobos, rival gang members who testified about shootings that they were the victims of, recorded statements of certain of the defendants themselves, along with physical corroborating evidence, including ballistics that connected the crimes committed by the hobos over the course of years. Turning first to the Wilbert Moore murder, which is the subject of the count 2 Vicar, as well as special findings on count 1. The jury reasonably found that counsel and Poe, with Bush's assistance, murdered Wilbert Moore in aid of the enterprise in retaliation for Moore providing information to the police that led to a search of counsel's residence. Ms. Armour contends that Moore was not actually the informant for that search warrant. Officer Utreus testified at trial that Moore was his informant. He identified him as a CI in the affidavit, consistent with CPD's practice. This was corroborated by the testimony of another CPD officer who also used Moore as an informant, and further corroborated by the district court's own findings after a Franks hearing that Officer Utreus credibly testified about information he received from Moore.
So let me ask you, Ms. Kastanek, one question about the notion that this was a planned and premeditated murder. It's, as far as I can tell, Bush tells somebody this blue thing is out here, and that somehow cascades into the whole sequence of various other people coming to the location and killing more, right, as they race down the street, and we have some other witnesses. That's pretty thin. This blue thing is out there? That's it?
I respectfully disagree, Your Honor, that that is very thin. And in fact, the coded use of the word blue thing demonstrates that this was the product of a plan. Moore's girlfriend testified that he often drove her blue car. Bush saw that car in front of a barbershop where Moore was. It took a single phone call referencing that blue thing to put into action a number of events, including an unidentified man arriving and verifying that Moore was in fact in the barbershop, and then Counsel Poe arriving within minutes, shooting out the window at Moore as he ran away. It was a coordinated, well-orchestrated plan that the jury could reasonably infer indicated that it was cold and calculated, premeditated, and planned. The fact that Counsel and Poe, with Bush's assistance, were responsible for this murder is corroborated not only by the testimony of Kevin Montgomery, but by admissions that Poe, Counsel, and Bush all made on different occasions to different people who testified at trial about their conversations about this murder. Illinois law reflects that a plan can be premeditated with only a few hours of a plan in support. And this case, you know, as I said, given the code word and the implications of putting into effect this well-orchestrated plan, indicated that it had been the product of conversations over the course of time. The evidence also amply supported the jury's findings as to the Terrence Anderson murder, which was the subject of count three, the Vicar count on count three, and the count one special findings. As Your Honors noted during questioning of defense counsel, Bush pleaded guilty to the murder of Terrence Anderson in state court. It was the product of a stipulation at trial that he knowingly and intentionally shot at Anderson, causing his death. In addition, both Bush and counsel admitted to the murder on different occasions to different people. So Bush to Chad Todd and Kevin Montgomery, counsel to Rodney Jones. In addition, before the murder, Bush told Todd that he was stalking Anderson's out date, meaning his prison release date, because he wanted to kill him as a result of their dispute over drug territory where Bush had a heroin line. All of this, coupled with the DNA that put counsel at the scene corroborating the witness accounts, was substantial and allowed the jury to infer that they were responsible for the murder. It was done in aid of the enterprise, and it was cold and calculated and premeditated.
So it's basically a territory dispute that sparks all of this that goes on for years?
Yes. Terry Anderson was a drug competitor back in 2000. Bush told him to stop distributing drugs at the location where he was distributing. It resulted in Anderson shooting Bush in the hand, and then Bush sending an individual girlfriend, and then Anderson got locked up, and when he was released, Bush wanted to preclude him from continuing to sell in that spot. So it was a dispute over drug territory consistent with the hobo's narcotics activity.
Okay.
With respect to counts four and five, which are the murders of Blewett and Neely, also forming the special findings on count one, there was substantial evidence that the hobos, including Derek Vaughn, murdered Antonio Blewett and Gregory Neely and did so in a premeditated, calculated fashion.
How important is it that the facts of how this unfolds, I mean, taking the evidence that the jury must have credited, a number of people come, they lie in wait outside the funeral home, and then they all jump in their cars, I guess, and it seems like people are making U-turns. Nobody knows who's the first car, who's the second car. Derek Vaughn is saying that his gun isn't working. I mean, it sounds chaotic to me. And then this other person doesn't think it was anything like that.
Yes, Your Honor. Is that there are minor inconsistencies in the evidence and the testimony, but they are that. They are just minor. And as the district court explained when it addressed this issue after trial, it said, you know, this was a very quick moving event. It had a lot of players involved. It is reasonable that there are minor inconsistencies in terms of who came first and who was in whose car. The fact of the matter is that from Derek Vaughn's perspective, he talked about this at length in his recorded conversations with Courtney Johnson. And he would have had no motive.
Would it matter that his gun jammed? That's what he said in the statement. Would that matter?
No, Your Honor, it would not matter. He could have aided and abetted that murder, that Vicar offense, by actively assisting in that murder. And he did so by showing up. He conducted surveillance. So he talked to Courtney Johnson about how he was behind those bushes. He was watching Blewett and Neely. He was actively engaged in those surveillance activities. He was present during the murder, adding strength and number. I would also note that there's an inconsistency between his own account and that of Rodney Jones. So his gun may have jammed and then it could have worked. We don't know. Rodney saw him shooting, but even if it was correct that his gun didn't fire, he doesn't need to be the shooter that causes those defendants to die in order to be accountable under either Vicar or in the RICO conspiracy. And in fact, in the RICO conspiracy, he didn't even need to be part of those predicate acts personally in order to be responsible for them under the 1962D. With respect to Keith Daniels, which is the subject of count six against Poe, again, the jury reasonably concluded that Poe killed Daniels to obstruct a federal investigation and case. There was-
Can you just say more about that? Because it seems quite clear to me that any jury could have found that there was a pending jury proceeding or grand jury investigation, and any jury could have found, based on this evidence, that Poe murders Daniels, maybe even with a long-term interest in shutting him up. But I am uncomfortable with the amount of evidence that shows that Poe was aware that there was actually, at the time he executes Daniels, that there is an ongoing either jury proceeding or grand jury investigation. I can think of first year law students who don't know the difference between a criminal information and a grand jury, and you're imputing a lot of sophistication to Poe.
Your Honor, I think that the evidence as to Poe's knowledge of the federal nature of the case and the investigation is actually very strong. So
is that enough? I mean, let's be precise. Would you agree? I'll ask you the same question I asked the other side. Under the statute, 1503A, is it enough for Poe to know that there's just a federal investigation going on, perhaps by the FBI, perhaps by special task forces, by anybody? Or does he have to know that this is reached the stage of a grand jury?
So he has to know that there is a judicial proceeding or a grand jury investigation. So I think that that's correct under the case law. He has to know of the nature of that investigation. But the evidence here is that he knew of at least one. So the indictment charged three proceedings. There were two active criminal proceedings, the one against Chester and the one against Dillard, who had been arrested federally. And then there was a federal grand jury investigation, which is the racketeering investigation. And there is evidence that he knew of all of these.
What's your best evidence then? Could you just review it for me?
Yes, Your Honor, I will. And I will say at the outset that I do not agree with Mr. Blagan's characterization that this is not a context in which jury inferences don't matter. They do. And so the government believes that all of this evidence taken together supports the jury's inference and finding on this. So first, a hobo, Walter Binion, was present for Chester's arrest. That arrest was not just conducted by state authorities. The CPD officers who were there were federal task force officers, and they were accompanied by an IRS agent, so a federal agent. This was 2 months after William Ford had been arrested by the FBI after he threatened Keith Daniels. So recall-
Ms. Kostanek, if I could just interrupt for a minute, is there any evidence that the federal agent that was there was identified as a federal agent? Is there anything in the record that he had on the IRS jacket or something else that someone could have identified him as one?
I don't know the answer. And look at the record to see if there's evidence that, you know, he had like an IRS jacket on or something of that sort. I don't know the answer to that. Chester's arrest came 2 months after Ford was arrested by federal authorities. This was, he had gone and he had threatened Keith Daniels, asked him to take a ride, and then federal authorities showed up at Ford's place, seized that marijuana and the gun and taken him into federal custody at that point.
Does that mean they brought him down to, you know, the MCC or to the FBI offices, or what does that really mean?
I don't know where he was brought, so I would have to check the record on that, but I do know that the FBI agent in the case was involved in the search of that residence. And I think it supports the inference that this was, you know, this larger federal investigation, which included girlfriends testifying in the federal grand jury, you know, cooperators testifying in the federal grand jury. There was, you know, it was not a very well-kept secret that Keith Daniels was cooperating with federal authorities. All of that supports the inference that Poe knew. Then, immediately after his arrest, Chester told people on the phone that he was arrested by federal authorities. So, April 12th, 2013, this is the day before the murder, Chester talked to a woman on the phone and he told her a quote, and excuse my language, a mother effer wore a wire on me, and quote, he's working with the feds. The fair inference from this, the district court held in ruling on the post-trial motions, was that Binion's presence at the time of the arrest, Chester's phone calls, and the subsequent events indicated that news of Chester's federal arrest, quote, spread rapidly. That's also supported by other conversations, recorded conversations between the hobos right around the time of the arrest and right afterwards. So in calls.
I don't mean to be, to push on this, but it's possible to be arrested before a case has been brought to the grand jury, right?
Mm-hmm. Correct.
So I'm fine with you that they knew that there was an investigation, that the feds were after them. My question is, how do we take the next step? How do we know it's all the way into the grand jury?
Yes, Your Honor. And just to be clear, they don't need to find that it is in the grand jury if they find that that the defendant, Poe, acted with intent to obstruct the ongoing federal case that Chester had been arrested for. So when Chester says to the woman on the phone, who is, you know, talking to other hobos, or it's a fair inference that she is, that he wore a wire on me and he's working with the feds, that relates not necessarily to that broader grand jury investigation, but to the active charged case against Chester that he's just been arrested for. And that would be sufficient, even putting aside the grand jury part of it. However, I would also
note, is the evidence with respect to Chester's case the strongest evidence as opposed to the grand jury investigation?
I think that they're both strong. So in a call directly between Chester and Poe, right around the time of Daniel's murder, Chester tells Poe on the phone, there's, quote, some other SH, excuse my language again, coming, quote, real soon, which the jury again could have reasonably inferred from that coded language that it's a larger, or it's a bigger reference to an investigation into the hobos that is a racketeering investigation, which they are concerned about. That's further supported by, there's a letter that Ford, who at that point is in custody, sent to his girlfriend, and he said, quote, the FBI is on Chester. So all of this, I understand that this isn't a letter sent by Poe, but it indicates that amongst the hobos, this has become common knowledge, the federal nature of this. Then May 1st, 2013, Kevin Daniels, who is a brother of counsel and a fellow hobo, is talking to counsel on the phone and he says, quote, he killed the federal informant. His kids were in the back seat, and when he got out of the car, they demonstrated on him. Boom. So the hobos are talking amongst each other about Daniels being a federal informant, well supporting the jury's finding on this. The Brian Zentmeyer, who is a cellmate of Poe, also testified that Poe told him that this was a joint state federal investigation, which it was. It was, we had task force officers working on this. He in fact crossed off in Zentmeyer's notes when Zentmeyer put state, and he, and Poe wrote down joint state federal investigation. And
how
although
do you respond to Mr. Blagan's argument that that particular evidence only applies after the fact, that we can't use that as an inference that he knew about this before the murder?
Of course, there's no legal bar to using that as an inference. The government agrees it's not dispositive. It speaks to his knowledge at the time that he's talking with Zentmeyer. But just as we draw inferences from statements after the fact all the time, the same is true here too. He's talking to Zentmeyer about the nature of the investigation that was ongoing and acknowledge that that investigation was state and federal. And we can draw reasonable inferences from that as the jury could as well in the context of the jury trial. Excuse me, I just need to grab some water. Turning, if your honors have no further questions about that topic, turning to the forfeiture by wrongdoing doctrine, the district court properly admitted Daniel's grand jury testimony under Rule 804b6 and the for forfeiture by wrongdoing exception to the Confrontation Clause. And it admitted that statement not only as to Poe, but as to his co-conspirators.
So this, this is one of a number of places in the government's case where there is really heavy reliance on Pinkerton, it seems to me. There's a lot where people aren't mentioned, but then it seems that, you know, it was reasonably foreseeable within the scope, et cetera, the Pinkerton things. Why would it have been so hard to have listed the names of the people that were responsible for this forfeiture by wrongdoing?
I'm not sure I understand what you mean by listed the names, but I do take your point that the government relies upon Pinkerton doctrine to extend this common law exception to the Confrontation Clause to Poe's co-conspirators. And it did so consistent with Thompson, in which this court held that forfeiture by wrongdoing extends to co-conspirators. It found it to be consistent with forfeiture by wrongdoing jurisprudence, including Supreme Court cases discussing the rule. It found that it struck an appropriate balance between, you know, witness intimidation and confrontation clause rights, and that it appropriately aligned the waiver with criminal liability standards, which otherwise there would be a discrepancy there that would make very, very little sense.
How is the application of Pinkerton to the forfeiture by wrongdoing theory consistent with common law? The defendants have argued you're violating common law by that extension.
Yes, Your Honor. And I, you know, conspiracy in the way that we fully understand it today may not have existed at common law, but what did exist is joint enterprise liability. So as Chief Judge Wood noted in one of the questions to defense counsel, Pinkerton is based on an agency theory. It's based on the idea that people act in conjunction with one another to commit an offense, and they're liable for the natural, foreseeable consequences of that agreement. And that did exist at common law. And one of the ways that you can know that it existed at common law is that another exception to the Confrontation Clause at common law was the co-conspirator exception to hearsay rules. So the Supreme Court discussed that in the Borgeli opinion, and they talk about it being an exception to the Confrontation Clause at common law, and that wouldn't exist if conspiracy liability didn't exist. It kind of conclusively demonstrates that it did, in addition to you know, the cases that the government cites in its brief concerning agency responsibility. It's also important to note that this court's opinion in Thompson, which the defense says is undermined by Giles, very much is not affected by Giles. So the court in Thompson, in holding that it makes sense to extend forfeiture by wrongdoing to co-conspirators, still applied a specific intent standard to the principles of that offense, and in fact found it not to be met as to the husband. But it did not find that that undermined the application of Pinkerton in that context. That's therefore consistent with Giles, which acknowledged a specific intent requirement at common law, because under Pinkerton, we impute the intent of the co-conspirator to the conspirators as long as it's within the scope of and in furtherance of that conspiracy. And in here, the hobos, one of the mantras was that you have to be loyal to the hobos, that you would be killed if you weren't loyal to the hobos. And that was the topic of testimony from cooperators, including Rodney Jones and Chad Todd. It was demonstrated by the murders of Keith Daniels and Wilbert Moore. It was demonstrated.
This is a legal question, though. And so the argument is not that about the facts, it's about the law. And we've had a confrontation clause revolution since Thompson was decided. And what we're instructed to do, and what Giles or Giles, in fact, does is look to the scope of the forfeiture by wrongdoing exception in 1791. And Pinkerton was a genuinely new rule when it was promulgated in 1946. Yes, 1946. It was a genuinely new rule of criminal liability in the context of conspiracy. It was unheard of. And controversial. So what the argument has to be, in order for you to prevail on this, that the scope of the forfeiture by wrongdoing doctrine in 1791 recognized Pinkerton style liability.
I beg to differ with that, Your Honor. I do not think that it needs to be that the cases applying forfeiture by wrongdoing recognized Pinkerton liability in that context. The court interprets a confrontation clause exception by reference to the common law. So in other words, this court does not have authority.
The common law as it existed in 1791.
Yes, Your Honor. So this court, in other words, cannot create new exceptions to the confrontation clause. That's correct. Forfeiture by wrongdoing, per Giles, is a exception to the confrontation clause. So
whether this expansion of the exception was known to the common law in 1791, this scope, this particular scope that imputed liability, vicarious liability.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
But Pinkerton is a form of vicarious liability.
Yes, Your Honor, it is. It's a form of, you know, agency doctrine, essentially. And what I'm taking issue with is the idea that the exception, the forfeiture by wrongdoing exception at common law, needs to look exactly as it does as applied to this case, to these co-conspirators. What I think that the proper way to look at this is there's an exception at common law to the confrontation clause where you engage in wrongdoing that makes a witness unavailable. You no longer have valid constitutional confrontation rights in that situation. How that gets applied to specific facts, including to other individuals who benefited from that wrongdoing, is, I think could be interpreted a little bit more broadly than simply looking at the case law as of the 18th century. So I think that that's consistent with this court's decision in Thompson. I think it's consistent with Giles. There's a number of cases, including a Fourth Circuit opinion in Dinkins, that recognizes that Pinkerton can still exist post Giles, and Giles is, you know, as you called it, kind of revolution in confrontation clause jurisprudence, and that would allow, you know, the court, and from a matter of fairness, I think the court should look at the facts and how the other co-conspirators in this case benefited from the killing of Keith Daniels, even if they were not actively involved in that killing. I would also note that, you know, if the court were to get to the point where it finds an error from a confrontation clause perspective, that the introduction of Keith Daniels' statement here was harmless. The statement was severely redacted after objections from the defense with regards to hearsay within hearsay, limitations on Keith Daniels' personal knowledge, et cetera. The court and counsel went through lengthy, lengthy dialogues that included redacting line by line this statement. And what was left was a pretty bare bones recitation of the hobos', you know, activities, violent drug, you know, robbery, drug related activities that was, you know, substantially replicated by other live testimony at trial. And so the government would urge that would be harmless if the court were to conclude that its admission was an error.
Thank you.
Was there anything in his statement that was not corroborated by one of the other cooperators?
Yes, Your Honor. There was information that he gave about Chester. Let me find exactly what he said here. So there would be a couple points. One is that he talked about Poe's plan to kill a BD for which he asked Daniels to act as security. He also talked about robberies in which Daniels and Chester participated. I would note that neither of these formed the basis of special findings, so they were part of the alleged conspiracy, but didn't change the defendant's offense levels or statutory maximum penalties. And there was other evidence of Chester engaged in robberies as well as Poe's violence, even if not specifically these incidents in question. I'll turn briefly, with the court's permission, to the Chester suppression issue. Defense counsel talked about this very briefly, and I'll do the same, but the district court properly denied the motion to suppress those October 2008 statements of police. We're not hearing you, Judge Wood.
Here's what worries me about that. It's the initial decision to stop the car, which I gather is not being, I don't know why they even knew Mr. Chester was in the car. He's not the driver, as I understand. It's Binion. And that just falls apart during the hearing. The district court has some pretty unflattering things to say about Officer Sanchez, who he winds up saying he's just unreliable. We can't do anything with him. So unless the government's theory is that the police can just pull any car off the road just to see, just in case, you know, maybe somebody is in it that they were investigating 4 weeks ago or whatever, there might be somebody in there with an active arrest warrant, there might be somebody in there that they have probable cause to arrest. We don't have even the usual, you know, you forgot to put your right blinker on. We don't have anything. And I'm concerned about that because everything else flows from it. If the stop is okay, then I understand it's the same team as who went to the Dearborn apartment. I understand the rest of it, but what justifies the stop?
Well, the stop is okay because it's supported by probable cause. So I don't think
Why is the stop supported by probable cause? What is it about that car that makes them think, aha, some, you know, an objective person who knows everything, you know, would know that there is a person in there that we ought to arrest for heroin dealing? In fact, they use all different kinds of cars, but I don't know why that stop ex ante is supported by probable cause. You can only come up with the probable cause by information gathered after it stopped.
Yes, Your Honor. So Sergeant Sanchez and Detective Brogan testified that they recognized Chester in the vehicle. So he was driving with his cousin, Walter Binion, a fellow hobo. And they stopped the
vehicle. Can we rely on what Officer Sanchez testified to in light of the district court's findings?
Yes, Your Honor. I understand Your Honor's point, and the government in its post-hearing briefing did not do so. But I believe, and I certainly can go back and double check, that Detective Brogan also testified at the suppression hearing. And if not, he certainly testified at trial. And I believe that he testified to seeing Chester in that vehicle. I believe he was the first one to curb the vehicle. And then the question is, well, so if the facts known to the officers at the time supported probable cause, even if it's not the stated reason for the stop. And the defense is...
We do need a legitimate stated reason for the stop. The stop cannot be justified based on things they find after the stop. So it's actually quite important whether Brogan says, I saw Chester, I happen to know that, whatever it was, 99.6 grams of heroin were found at the Dearborn apartment. Because the government, as Judge St. Eve was pointing out, as I'm saying, had to relinquish its reliance on Sanchez.
Yes, Your Honor. And I think that the evidence is very strong that when they stopped that vehicle and took Chester into custody, assuming that that happened and he did not go voluntarily with them, that they had probable cause. So there was testimony at the suppression hearing that, in fact, during the interview that immediately followed in October of 2008, they talked to him about being the subject of the search warrant of the Dearborn apartment. So they asked him about the heroin. They showed him pictures of it. He looked at it.
And all of that depends, as I'm trying to say to you. I mean, if you can get that stop properly justified, then the knowledge that they had of the discovery of the heroin at the apartment, the link between the apartment and Chester, it seems like there's evidence in the record about that. They take him to the Holman Street station. He seems to have, had a full and frank discussion of what a successful drug dealer he is. Kind of weird conversation, but I get that once that first initial hurdle is done, you probably are all right. But it's that initial stop that bothers me.
Yes, Your Honor. And with the court's permission, I'd like to go back to the suppression hearing testimony. And if you would like us to do a supplemental letter on the point of what officer saw Chester in that vehicle, resulting in it being pulled over.
Okay, that would be okay. Why don't you file that within, let's see, today is Wednesday, just 7 days from now.
Thank you.
So Detective Brogan did testify at the suppression hearing, and the judge didn't raise any credibility issues with respect to him. I think the question, Ms. Kostanek, is, in light of the problems with Officer Sanchez's testimony at the hearing and the district court's credibility findings, did Detective Brogan testify separately as to seeing Chester in the car before they pulled the car over to give that initial reasonable suspicion to pull the car over?
Yes, understood, Your Honor. And the government will provide some supplemental information on that topic.
And I should say, for the benefit of defense counsel, who I assume are listening, that if you would like to file a letter on this topic also simultaneously within 7 days, that would be fine.
Thank you, Your Honor. I also would note, or just bring to the court's attention, that in response to the defendant's argument that the arresting officers, so in this case, Sanchez and Brogan, did not know about the information that tied Chester to this residence. The defense actually, Chester called these officers at the trial, and he asked the officers about their interview of Chad Todd. So although neither of them were the affiant on the search warrant, they testified that they actually collected the information from Chad Todd about Todd being in Chester's apartment on Dearborn, seeing the gun that provided the probable cause for the affidavit that was signed off by Officer Torba, who was an officer on their team. And so they had personal knowledge of Chester's link to that apartment that would have provided the probable cause that we're talking about. The government also maintains that the introduction of this statement would have been harmless at trial in light of all of the other evidence that Chester was the leader of the hobos. Every cooperator that the government called who had intimate knowledge of the hobos testified about Chester's leadership. It was corroborated by the recorded statements of various defendants talking about the hierarchy of the hobos. And then Chester himself testified about being a major heroin dealer, which would be, duplicative of the evidence from his own statement that he was the breadwinner of the hobos due to his narcotics trafficking.
I was thinking you would probably say that, and if I were on the defense side, I might respond that it's one thing to have a bunch of discredited and lying and inconsistent cooperators say this. It's quite another having it come right out of Chester's own mouth, and it might have a much greater impact on the jury that way. So in light of that, would you still say it's harmless?
The government does maintain it's harmless, Your Honor. There were many, many cooperators, and focusing on the defendant's statements where they were recorded statements about the hierarchy of the of the hobos. We're talking about extensive details about Chester, you know, exercising authority over the hobos. It's also corroborated by the actions of the hobos. So they engaged in the Blewett-Neely murders in retaliation for Chester's shooting in the Newtown territory. He put a bounty on Blewett's head, and all of the hobos gathered together, banded together to kill the head of this other gang in protection of Chester. Poe at a Southside car wash in 2006, when Chester was being shot at, got out of the car and shot back. The Keith Daniels murder is another example of them trying to band together and protect their leader. So it's well corroborated by a number of different factual circumstances that I think reduce the impact of a defendant's own statements about things like being a leader of the gang.
Is there anything that came in from his statements at the station that was not independently proved up through some other source? Are there any statements he made? In other words, that one of the cooperators or his own statements at trial didn't somehow corroborate?
There was some discussion in his statement about how, you know, when the officers were doing surveillance of him, that he knew of the surveillance. I think that that's not anywhere else in the trial transcript, but it's also irrelevant to the ultimate issues of guilt. So I think the real significant portions of Chester's statement are him saying, I'm, you know, the leader of the hobos, I'm the breadwinner, I bring in the money. And I think that that's the part that was focused on by both of the parties here and is harmless for the reasons I just said. Turning to the sentence of life imprisonment for the aggravated murders under count one, the defendant's life sentences were lawful. Each of the defendants was convicted of count one, and the jury returned special findings that the racketeering activity upon which their conspiracy was based included murders punishable by life under Illinois law. So the defendants engage in this reliance on Mathis that is largely inapplicable here. So section 1961 contains a list of enumerated offenses, racketeering acts that include murder. The role of Mathis analysis for enumerated offenses is that it protects against a state that uses the word murder, but encompasses broader conduct. And here, the use of aggravating murders under 1963A to enhance a statutory maximum in fact, limits rather than expands that predicate offense. It's no different than, you know, in the Johnson context where you have an aggravated battery or an aggravated murder and that underlying base offense qualifies, but there's nothing that prohibits the defendant from being punished for an aggravated version of that offense. Here that makes sense because under 1963A, the provision regarding life imprisonment would otherwise be a nullity. There would be no offenses that would ever qualify in the generic form of that offense under state law for life imprisonment. And that's what the statute specifically contemplates. These statutes should be read in conjunction with one another. It's also incorrect that the predicate for the defendant's offenses is conspiracy to commit murder rather than murder itself. So, as I just said, 1963 contains these two levels of punishment, a base level of up to 20 years, and then the enhanced level for aggravated offenses that are punishable by life. And it says specifically that there's a life qualifying enhancement if the underlying racketeering activity upon which the violation is based is punishable by life. And here the violation is RICO conspiracy, whereas the racketeering activity that's referred to is the underlying murder. So it's not correct that conspiracy somehow overlays this, state analysis. The defendants were given appropriate notice of the enhanced penalties. So count one comported with the guidance in Banabi, which recognizes that there's a few ways to get an enhanced penalty. You can participate in the activity yourself, you can aid and abet it, or you can be liable where that qualifying activity was foreseeable and in the scope of the conspiracy. And the count one alleges that each of the defendants were members of the conspiracy, that murders were conducted as a part of the conspiracy. So on page 6, it goes through the various, that murders were an object of the conspiracy, that the means and methods of the conspiracy included murders of cooperating witnesses, and then it lists the murders personally committed by various members of the conspiracy under paragraphs, subparagraph R on page 10. And that provided sufficient notice that these defendants would be on the hook for the enhanced penalties that then are listed in the notice of the special findings. With respect to...
You are also, as I understand, relying on the fact that you didn't need specifically to charge the Pinkerton theory in the indictment, the cases that say that, because you could have said a little bit more, and these murders are reasonably foreseeable and blah, 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 and so we're going to hold you responsible.
Yes, Your Honor. Certainly, the law does not require us to allege Pinkerton specifically. I would also just throw in there that, you know, there were special findings as to each of these defendants at trial that would have made any implication, you know, any errors in the indictment completely harmless, because the special findings were made and made all of this largely go away. So with respect to Stanley Vaughn's sentence, which was run consecutive to an uncharged narcotic sentence imposed by a court in Springfield, the district court did not commit procedural error here. The court properly calculated the guidelines. It recognized that 5G 1.3b says that the court shall impose a concurrent sentence for undischarged terms of imprisonment. It also engaged in a back and forth with the parties in which it clarified that everybody recognizes that the guidelines and therefore 5G are advisory. And as Judge St. Eve noted, unlike the advisory guidelines, statutes are mandatory, and Section 3584A permits the district court to run a sentence concurrent or consecutive with a determination made by reference to the 3553A factors. And here, the district court engaged in a lengthy, reasonable analysis of those 3553A factors. It found that it would be improper to impose a concurrent sentence where Stanley Vaughn did not receive any sentence that accounted for his violent, extremely violent murders that he engaged in and participated in as part of this conspiracy.
So if I understand your opponent's position, I'm not sure I do, but I believe that he's arguing that although the guidelines, of course, are advisory, you still have to compute the sentence, both the level and the criminal history and enhancers and subtractors. And so he seems to be saying that you need to follow the advice that this type of sentence, where there was relevant conduct, should have been concurrent, and then move over to the 3553A factors, to which 3584 directs you, and see if that sentence strikes you as appropriate, or if you then want to override it and say, no, actually, this time it should be either partially or fully consecutive. Kind of an extra step, it seems to me, because of the anchoring effect of the correctly computed guidelines sentence.
I just don't think that that's correct, Your Honor. 1B1.2 directs the court to go through and calculate the guidelines. So that means starting with Chapter 2, calculating the base offense levels, taking into account any cross-references, going through Chapter 3 and applying offense levels, going through Chapter 4, calculating the criminal history, and that's what's contemplated in 1B. Chapter 5 provides a number of guidelines that govern the way that a sentence is implemented. There's no calculating under 5G1.3 in the way that the defense is contemplating. What needs to be done is that the court should acknowledge that 5G1.3 says that where it's relevant conduct, there's this presumption that it should be run concurrently to the undischarged sentence. But again, advisory guidelines, so the court, as it concluded here, is well within its discretion in reference to the 3553A factors where appropriate to say, I'm not going to run that sentence concurrent. That doesn't account for the conduct that's at issue in this case. And that's what happened, and that's what was reasonable under these circumstances. With respect to the Byron Brown.
Can I turn to Chester's sentence? Because it raises something you just mentioned. The district court did not calculate the guidelines for Mr. Chester's sentencing. Why isn't that an error?
So the government acknowledges that the court should have calculated the guidelines on the record. What actually happened is that the PSR calculated the guidelines, the parties agreed, the court adopted the PSR, and then you'll see in the statement of reasons that the court, you know, adopts it without objection. So, you know, the defense never asked the court to make that more explicit on the record. Both of the parties assumed that, you know, essentially, even though those cases were not consolidated, they were treated as if it was a narcotics count in addition to that RICO conspiracy count. And it kind of fell, you know, in order of importance because he had a life guideline on the RICO conspiracy count, it kind of fell by the wayside. And so although, you know, that I would characterize it as kind of minimal procedural misstep, and the court well justified its sentence for Chester by departing downwards from the life guidelines on the RICO conspiracy count, going upwards on the guidelines for the heroin count. But what resulted, a 40-year concurrent sentence on both, was very reasonable in light of Chester's role in the hobos and the violence that he incited, as well as what the court found to be his perjury in his testimony at trial.
Oh, so I was worried about that missing step too. Unlikely though it seems, I was thinking, well, suppose Congress later comes along with a retroactive statute, which of course we've been seeing in the drug area, but suppose it did for racketeering offenses, and what was a 40-year sentence on the racketeering offense would be eligible to be a 30-year sentence, which is still a pretty long sentence. And now here he would be with this 40-year heroin sentence and no thinking, as his counsel has urged, about why it's so far above. I mean, why did they have to be that high? When they're concurrent sentences anyway, you know, the drug sentence could have been 20 years and the racketeering 40 years. He'd still wind up spending 40 years in prison in the absence of the kind of change I'm hypothesizing. So, you know, we don't want the district judges to just say, oh, well, it doesn't really matter, it's concurrent.
Yes, Your Honor, and I recognize the concern. I don't think we'll ever be in a situation like that with respect to the RICO conspiracy, given that the guideline was life. And so it doesn't function quite like the drug guidelines do, where there could be a cap that's reduced given, you know, subsequent legislation. So I don't think it's a real world problem here. And as the defense concedes, I believe in the reply brief, you know, at the end of the reply brief on this question, they say, you know, this would only be harmful if in fact they win their argument as to the life imprisonment on count one, the statutory argument, Mathis type notice argument that we just talked about. And so I think there's, you know, recognition by all sides here that, again, the court should have calculated those guidelines, you know, gone through those procedural steps, but that does not mean that it requires remand or that there's any harmful impact on the defendant in this particular case. Turning to Byron Brown, the district court did not abuse its discretion in denying the motion to withdraw a plea without a hearing. He claimed in his motion that he did not know he would be required to testify against his co-defendants. This is a completely incredible claim. So there was an entire section of the plea agreement that discussed his obligations under the cooperation deal. It specifically said he was required to, quote, give complete and truthful testimony in any criminal proceeding. Brown confirmed at the change of plea that he had read that provision. The judge asked the government to summarize it, which the government did, including that he would be required to testify at criminal proceedings. Brown confirmed that he understood. And the fact that he knew he would have to testify was confirmed by the fact that he had just in fact testified not that long ago in the federal grand jury against his co-defendants who had yet to plead guilty. He claimed in his motion that he received ineffective assistance from one of his two attorneys. The district court acted within its discretion in finding those arguments to be unpersuasive and, again, incredible. There were contradictions in his motion versus his affidavit with regards to whether the attorneys allegedly knew at the time of the testimony of its falsity. The motion said they found out afterwards, making the advice that they gave the defendant quite reasonable. The district court was not required to hold a hearing, and There would have been no prejudice. He cannot get the relief he seeks. He wants to force the government to abide by the terms of a cooperation deal, even though he acknowledges that he provided the government with false information, making the cooperation deal no longer enforceable. The government, under the terms of that contract, is given discretion as to whether or not to give the defendant the benefit of that deal, and therefore the district court appropriately denied the motion to withdraw his plea. If there are no further questions from the court, the government asks the court to affirm the defendant's convictions and sentences.
I see no further questions, and so we thank you. And we will now, as I indicated at the beginning, take about a four or five minute pause, and then we will return for the rebuttal arguments. So is everybody back? I think so. All right, well, I have requests for rebuttal time from everybody, so I will just go down the list unless there have been any changes that council want to notify me of. Everyone's saying no. Okay, fine. So Ms. Westover, we'll start with you.
Yeah, Your Honor.
At some point, I'm going to jump in since your time is limited. Could you please address the question of the harm on Mr. Chester's sentence by the judge not calculating the guidelines on the heroin case?
Sure. I agree that to some extent it's concurrent. So in that sense, it doesn't matter to him in terms of his quality of life. But our concern is that, as Judge Wood said, something could happen in the future on the RICO case. And the fact that, and we maintain that he shouldn't have been able to be sentenced above 20 years on the RICO case, right? And in light of that, I think just throwing the two together and saying, well, it's all the same, and not considering at least the guideline range or explaining why the sixfold increase in the guidelines on the drug count is a very prejudicial error. But that is essentially our position, yes.
And if that's the case, what's the way to cure it? Would it be a resentencing or a technical calculation?
I think a resentencing. I mean, we wouldn't have to do the, at least to allow the judge to explain what his thinking was, right? If he's saying under 3553, Mr. Chester is such a bad guy, I don't care what the guidelines are, then I think he needs to say that and explain it. But if what he was doing was just, hey, I'm lumping them together, so who cares? I think we need to remand to make sure that that's not what he's doing at the very least. That's our position. Okay, what I want to talk about is general harmlessness as to Mr. Chester. And I'm sort of going to group the statement and Mr. Daniels' grand jury testimony together. As relates to Mr. Chester, the evidence in this case was not very strong. There was a lot of it. I mean, there was a lot of evidence in the case, but not a lot of it related to Mr. Chester. Mr. Daniels' statement and Mr. Chester's statements are the only two pieces of witness testimony that put Mr. Chester in a leadership position in the Hobos. None of the cooperators say that they saw Mr. Chester direct any sort of activity to the Hobos. The cooperator, I think, I forget which one, testified that Mr. Chester didn't front drugs to any Hobos. He sold them, but he didn't front them. And all of them, and Chad Todd participated in a number of shootings and said Mr. Chester did not participate in any of them, and as near as he knew, didn't know about any of them. Similarly, Mr. Daniels' statement is the only statement that links Mr. Chester to violence. All of the, Jones originally testified that Mr. Chester solicited the Blewett Neely murder, but by the end of his cross-examination, he took it back, admitted that was the lie, admitted that he lied to the government in order to curry favor with them by putting the solicitation in Mr. Chester's hands, and it never happened. So the evidence as to Mr. Chester is not as strong. And I think that especially on the special findings, which were in furtherance of that violence, in the absence of Mr. Daniels' statement, I don't think that they can get within the scope of Mr. Chester's agreement or in furtherance of Mr. Chester's agreement on those special findings as to the violence. So I think it's very difficult for the government to maintain that the Daniels statement or Mr. Chester's own statement, either of those are harmless. The other thing is that you know, we've referred to the cooperators in this case as unsavory. The cooperators in this case go a long way below unsavory. I mean, the cooperators in this case admitted to lying about at least Mr. Chester. Two of them, two law enforcement, for the purpose of falsely incriminating him, for the purpose of getting a benefit of their sentence. Right? And I think that's especially problematic, and I think the court can take that into account in the harmless error analysis.
But the jury was warned about that. They were given the special caution instruction.
Sure, but for the purpose of the harmless error analysis, I think the court can take that into account. The court, the jury found them, may have found them credible, but in the context of Mr. Chester's statement being admitted into court, in the context of the grand jury statement being admitted into court, I don't think you get Mr. Chester convicted on the testimony of Jones, Chad, and Montgomery.
Okay. I think you're just about done, unless you have one more sentence.
Mr. Brogan was not at the suppression hearing.
Mr. Brogan, well, all right, well, so much for that. We will see what the government can tell us. And as I say, defense counsel are welcome if you have something to file, please, the same time schedule.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Next we have Mr. Greenberg.
Yes, Your Honor. I'm going to keep this very brief. I don't know that I'll use all my time. The government spoke about the indictment and said that people were charged with things in count one, and therefore they were liable for the things, liable for the underlying crimes. I want to be clear. The individual defendants were charged in count one. It would say, for instance, defendant A committed the murder of this person. Defendant B committed the murder of this person. There was a separate section of the indictment the government didn't just mention to you. I talked about the penalties. In that section, and that's where we're complaining about the Apprendi violation, in that section it said, and the named defendant committed the crime in a cold and calculating way, or the named defendant committed the crime with the enhancing factors. Nowhere in count one does Chester or Ford appear next to anyone named for any murder, including Blewett and Neely, which is what Ford ultimately got enhanced for. Turning to the other argument, the so-called categorical approach argument, there are different ways they could have charged this. They charged a conspiracy. It's a conspiracy to commit an act. If they had wanted Mr. Ford and other people to be responsible for specific murders, then they should have charged those specific murders under Vicar. Otherwise, why have the separate Vicar statute? That statute allows them to do what they wanted to do here. But instead, what they did was they sort of conflated a bunch of different things. The concept of a 1962 D conspiracy with Pinkerton liability, which wouldn't apply under Illinois law. They couldn't have done that under Illinois law. And then ignoring what's meant by maximum penalty. We always say maximum penalty is the basic penalty. Somehow reading it to an Apprendi. So we, or not Apprendi, but jury finding a statutory maximum above the statutory maximum. What we got here, I know it's a convoluted argument, and I'm sort of convoluted trying to say it, but it's also a practical argument. They took everything, they sort of threw it all in like a jambalaya, and they said, let's come out with something that subjects these guys to life. They could have done it the right way by charging the Vicar murders, and they didn't. I'll yield the rest of my time.
All right, thank you very much, Mr. Greenberg. Next I have Ms. Armour.
Thank you. Judge, you correctly went to the heart of the government's serious problems with the Wilbert Moore special findings. This murder was purportedly put in place by Bush on January 19, 2006, by this calling and saying, this blue thing is out here. Our reply at pages 29 to 30 explains the reasons why we dispute this. But the government concedes that they arrived within just minutes. To lawfully apply this aggravating factor, a murder must be committed pursuant to a preconceived plan and design. We need an extended period of deliberation, which is entirely missing here. And the government has no evidence on this point. It is just—
Well, I suppose they're asking us to infer that there must have been a plan if they got there that fast and acted that fast. And I take it your position is that you would need some evidence of the earlier planning.
That's our position. And I think that's the position of the Illinois Supreme Court in Williams, which addresses this exact scenario at pages 38 to 39. I hate to read things from a case, but it is so precisely on point. It's says, according to the state, the fact that the murder occurred quickly indicates that it was planned in advance. But there was no evidence that they deliberated over a period of time, and I just paraphrase that section. And then moving on to where 38 and 39 meet, the fact that the murder occurred quickly does not show that the defendant engaged in a substantial period of reflection. This is not such a case where the manner in which the murder was committed was so particular or exacting that an inference would be appropriate. So I think the government's whole theory is answered by Williams. That's not what we're looking at. The reason the Illinois legislature spent so much time debating this, and the reason why the Illinois Supreme Court consistently maintains a hard temporal boundary, this is not a momentary thing. This is not to get at momentary impulsive murder. And there's more that is needed. This does not evince the kind of proof or extended deliberation that is appropriate under the law. And therefore, it is not reasonable and was not reasonable for a jury to infer that counsel and Poe, Gabriel Bush participated in this murder pursuant to a preconceived plan and design.
Okay, I think that's got to be it. All right, thank you. Ms. Bierma.
Thank you, Your Honors. I just have a few factual clarifications based on the government's argument related to the Terrence Anderson murder. The government asserted that Mr. Bush was shot in the hand by Mr. Anderson and that then the subsequent murder was as a result of a dispute over drug territory. And I would respectfully submit that there was no evidence in the record connecting the shooting of Mr. Bush to any dispute over drug territory that occurred a few years later. And also the stalking Mr. Anderson's outdate was, again, with one of the, as the court has characterized them, unsavory cooperators. And I would just like to clarify that, and I would yield the rest of my time to my co-counsel.
All right, thank you. Mr. Geiger.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. The government says that we are complaining about minor inconsistencies in the Blewett Mealy murders. It's not a minor inconsistency whether or not their star witness, Rodney Jones, was there. And we have evidence from their other great care and caution witness, Chad Todd, doesn't put him there. We have the tape recording of my client, Derek Vaughn, doesn't put him there. Doesn't put Rodney Jones there. Also, the government said he may have made a mistake or he may have seen him shoot, the gun may have worked, may not have worked. Well, the question that was asked, or at least the very beginning of the question, I'll quote it, were you able to see shots fired in reference to coming from the car where my client was allegedly located? That was the question. It wasn't, did you see him shooting? It was, were you able to see shots fired? So that's how it was asked. That's not a minor problem. Four or five cars in a train shooting full of shooters versus one car shooting.
Do we have a problem here? It looks like it's sort of frozen on Mr. Geiger.
Yeah, I do not know what happened there.
We'll obviously.
The penalty testimony came from
Chad. He's back, yeah.
You froze for just a moment.
So if you'd like to.
I'm on my I'm on my very last sentence.
Okay.
The bounty testimony came from Chad Todd, who admitted during cross-examination that he never told agents about any bounty when he first met with them. That came out later. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Geiger. Mr. Blagan, you're next.
Okay. Judge. I didn't mean to say that, I didn't think I did say that the jury's inferences don't matter. The inferences do matter. It's what the district court and this court have to determine whether they're reasonable or not. What I meant to say is the witness's credibility findings don't matter. Even if you believe Zentmeyer, there's a million reasons you shouldn't, but even if you do, he doesn't give you evidence that Poe knew beforehand that Mr. Daniels was working for the feds. I think the grand jury issue is clear cut. It wasn't proven. The issue that remains is whether he knew that Chester was charged, or Mr. Dillard were charged in these specific cases. So to Judge St. Eve's question, I went back and looked at the transcripts and our reply brief. We did address the IRS agent issue. It's the testimony of Mr. Chester's arrest is in volume 41A at page 95, 81, and thereabouts. There was no indication that he was identified as an IRS agent, that he was wearing IRS clothing or any of those sorts of things. The other issues that the government raised today are not in their brief, so I don't know exactly, and I wasn't able to find them in the transcripts in the meantime, but I don't believe and I don't recall that there were multiple girlfriends who were getting grand jury subpoenas in this case. I don't, certainly not before Mr. Daniels was killed. I don't think that's the case. There are, you know, there are other reported cases where they prove somebody knows of a grand jury proceeding because they know a witness who got a grand jury subpoena. That's not the case here. The other thing they seem to be saying is that because other hobos may have known some things, Mr. Poe must have known them. That's not a reasonable inference based on the circumstances. One, Mr. Poe was on the run for much of this time that these people knew these things. Mr. Counsel and Kevin Daniels, when they discussed it, they are Keith Daniels' brothers. They know Keith Daniels' family and his girlfriend and his children. They would know things, and even then, that phone call was after the fact. They would know things that Mr. Poe didn't know. The district court decided that Mr. Poe must have known of those federal criminal charges, and they have to prove that he knew of that, the ones in the indictment, because he didn't ask Mr. Chester on the phone. That is an unreasonable inference. There are a million reasons he might not have asked. One, he might not have cared. Mr. Chester had told him the charges weren't serious. Poe was on the run anyway. What Mr. Chester told him was, there's nothing here that is serious. I don't want you to do anything, but there's other charges coming. That's what causes Poe to run. And that doesn't tell him anything about who charged Chester, the feds, the state. He was in the Kankakee jail. Why isn't it equally as reasonable to infer that they were state charges?
Okay.
Close to my time, so thank you very much.
All right, thank you very much, Mr. Blagan. Next, Mr. Herman.
Yes, Chief Judge Wood, I'm sorry if I wasn't clear about my arguments, which you articulated regarding the application of the guidelines as a preliminary step. And the government in its argument referred to section 1B1.2. Well, prior to that, in 1B1.1, which I had referenced before, the last step in subsection A is to look at chapter 5. And then in subsection C, you proceed to 3553. So the concern is exactly what you said, is anchoring. It's framing the sentencing procedure and starting from the right position. And to Judge St. Eve's point about the 3584, yes, there's no doubt that there's discretion, but the district court still needs to consider 5G 1.3, and this court's decisions, for instance, in Nania, there's an extensive discussion about the application of the guidelines. We don't just straight jump to, well, 3584 is out there and the judge's discretion is sound. And I'd like to end with, we cite a case, Witt, W-I-T-T-E, regarding the fortuity of separate prosecutions leading to an excessive sentence. In the government's brief at page 203, when discussing Gregory Chester's sentence, it notes, as if this would have been a single case, the narcotics case was subsumed in the greater case. And that's the problem that we had here. If this was a single sentence, Mr. Vaughn would have looked at a 20-year maximum, 240 months. Instead, his sentence was 502 months. We'd ask for a remand for resentencing. Thank you.
All right, thank you. And finally, Mr. Mitchell.
Yes, Judge. Again, I would just like to address the prejudice issue that I didn't get a chance to speak to before, where the indication is that, yes, the government has undue discretion to declare that the false statements at the grand jury was a breach. And I understand that, Judge. The question with Mr. Brown is, he was at a catch-22. At the time that he was going to testify at the grand jury, according to the allegations, and the judge sort of says, even if it's true, that you told your attorney that you were going to have, that this wasn't true, and he advised you to stay with your story, the question is that if he was willing to do it at that point, based on his attorney's advice, what would cause him to then want to withdraw his guilty plea? The only basis is that he did not know that he was going to have to do anything further after the grand jury. And that lack of explaining is what the ineffective assistance is. And so the prejudice there is exactly what happened. It would be a whole nother matter if he knew that this next step was going to occur. They're going to withdraw it if you don't testify in the grand jury, if you make this allegation. And there's no evidence in the record that he did that. And so the only thing that we want to point out is that, in fairness to Mr. Brown, given the timing, given the way this was happening, it would have been very simple simply to have a hearing to take this testimony and not simply assume, without hearing anything, that Mr. Brown is telling a lie about everything that occurred, which would require him to ask for him to withdraw his guilty plea. He's not saying he didn't do it. He simply says that I was led to even not even make a deal that I was counseled to get, and my attorney knew that. And so that's the essence of what we're asking, is for an evidentiary hearing to get that to happen. And so we would ask for remand to get that additional evidence.
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Mitchell. Thanks to all counsel. I believe almost all of you were appointed. We very much appreciate your service to the client, to the court. We couldn't do our job without you. And we will take these cases, these many cases, under advisement. And the court will now be in recess.
Thank you.